This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, Vanuatu's golden passports may be tarnished by a European Union suspension. An escalation in alcohol-fueled violence in Port Moresby prompts calls for a review of PNG's liquor laws, and a warning that if the IOC carries out its threat to expel weightlifting from the 2028 Olympics, then the sport in the Pacific will die. Those stories to come, but first there are fresh calls in Papua New Guinea for more to be done to tackle sorcery accusation-related violence. This after the police in Port Moresby rescued a woman who was being held captive and tortured after she was accused of practicing witchcraft. Violence against men, women and children on the basis of sorcery allegations has been a huge problem in PNG for decades, with some estimates pointing to as many as 700 cases a year. PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reports.
Across Papua New Guinea, there's a network of people who quietly try to alert authorities if someone is being tortured after being accused of practicing sorcery. Usually, the cases are in remote parts of the country's highlands. But this week, the tip-off that came into local NGO The Tribal Foundation was about a woman in the capital, Port Moresby. GT Buston from The Tribal Foundation says they immediately notified police, who sent officers.
And they found the lady tied under a house. She had been tortured for several days, on and off. They said it was really good they were able to rescue her. She may have been killed that night.
Yeah, I understand that this woman was brought to Tribal Foundation for care afterwards. How is she?
Yeah, she's actually doing better than expected. She was tortured, but not as severely as many of the cases that we've seen. So they used some knives and some hot instruments on her, and so she was burned and cut, and then also she had been beaten, but she was, considering everything, she was in fairly good condition.
It comes just weeks after a video emerged of five women being tortured in the Southern Highlands. It's believed three of them may have died. Mr. Buston says it's estimated there are between 500 and 700 cases a year.
Oftentimes they're quiet and people aren't told about them. I think the one that happened in the Southern Highlands actually happened a while back, but the videos were just now surfacing.
In response to the video from the Southern Highlands, Port Moresby Governor and co-chair of the country's Parliamentary Committee on Gender-Based Violence, Powers Parkop, presented a cheque of 50,000 kina to assist police with its investigation.
We don't want anybody, particularly women and girls, to be subjected to this type of violence anymore. Enough is enough.
At a joint press conference, Deputy Police Commissioner Anton Billet says the area is very remote and can only be accessed on foot.
The location that this incident happened, there is no road link, no access. So it's only bushland that you have to walk one day to get your scene. The only is on the village ward councillors and the leaders to cooperate, because we cannot accept such treatment to be given to our women.
A shortage of officers and the remoteness of the locations mean people are rarely arrested or prosecuted for sorcery-based violence. While there is a cultural belief in sorcery in many parts of PNG, GT Buston says the practice of accusing and torturing people is not traditional.
What's happening now never happened. When I grew up in the Southern Highlands in the remote areas, we had witch doctors, but they were respected people and no one would ever torture them. But now we have the same areas. They're now identifying vulnerable women as being the sorcerer and then torturing them.
Those women are often targeted after being accused by a person called a glass man or glass woman. The glass men are paid to supposedly identify a sorcerer, usually after an unexplained death in a community. They normally identify a vulnerable woman who can't defend herself. The Tribal Foundation wants a focus on prosecuting these glass men.
So we have to hold people to account. And whenever the leaders get serious and actually hold people to account and put their resources in to stop it, it can be stopped quite quickly.
So far, no one has been arrested over the detainment and torture of the woman in Port Moresby, but investigations are ongoing. Given the case happened in the middle of the country's capital, advocates are hoping this year will begin with arrests and prosecutions.
PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reporting there. The Vanuatu economy is on the line, with one of the country's main sources of income in jeopardy. A large portion of Vanuatu's revenue comes from selling passports to foreign nationals for $130,000. But as Marion Farr reports, a major selling point of that citizenship scheme, visa-free access to European Union countries, could soon be suspended.
Vanuatu citizenship comes with an alluring promise.
If you hold a Vanuatu passport, you are then able to enter most of the European Union without the requirement to obtain a visa first.
The little green passport grants its owner visa-free travel to countries within the European Union. That's been the major selling point for Vanuatu's lucrative citizenship by investment scheme, a program that allows foreign nationals to purchase a passport for $130,000.
We've seen the number of applications to those schemes ramp up significantly. We've seen the marketing of those schemes also be increased.
But the so-called Golden Passport Scheme has been mired in controversy. Dr. Tess Newton-Cain leads the Pacific Hub at the Griffith Asia Institute, and she's also a Vanuatu passport holder.
There have been concerns from the EU, from the IMF, from the OECD over quite some time about the processes associated with those schemes in terms of how much scrutiny there is of applicants, what the levels of investigation are into their background, their financial status, whether they have criminal records and those sorts of things.
An investigation by The Guardian last year found Vanuatu had granted citizenship to a number of international fugitives. Now the European Union is seeking to suspend its visa-free travel arrangement with the Pacific nation.
Their position is that those concerns have been raised and that they are not satisfied with the steps that Vanuatu has taken or has said that it can take to address them. And so their proposal, and it is only a proposal at this stage, is to partially suspend that visa-free aspect of the passport.
The suspension would apply to anyone who acquired a Vanuatu passport on or after the 25th of May 2015. People in that category would not be able to travel to EU nations without first obtaining a visa. In a statement announcing the proposal, the European Commission says Vanuatu's citizenship scheme presents serious deficiencies and security failures, citing concern about the country's process for screening applicants. The Commission says the processing time is too short and the rejection rate is too low. It also raised concern that Vanuatu had granted citizenship to a number of foreign nationals listed on Interpol databases.
This issue of the passports and the citizenship by investment, it's been a thorn in the side of the relationship for some time.
If the proposal to suspend visa-free travel goes ahead, it could have major ramifications for Vanuatu.
Well, I personally think it's actually very serious because the government in the country relies, you know, a lot on this income.
Catherine Boudier is an approved citizenship agent in Vanuatu. She believes people will stop purchasing Vanuatu citizenship if visa-free travel to the EU is no longer on the table.
But a lot of the inquiries and why the clients have been contacted us is to be able to travel in Europe. So it is important and will have a negative impact.
In 2020, Vanuatu's citizenship scheme made up 42% of all government revenue. Without that source of income, there's concern that the country's economy will suffer.
If I was in finance and economic management department in the government, I'd be very stressed right now about how, you know, we can afford to pay doctors and nurses and keep hospitals open and those sort of services.
Glenn Craig is head of the Vanuatu Business Resilience Council.
You can imagine the downstream effects on health services, education, governance, policing.
He believes some of the EU's concerns are unwarranted.
So it takes about 60 days going through the due diligence period, the processing, the hearing at the Citizenship Commission. It goes through about three steps. So I don't think they're valid.
But Dr. Tess Newton-Cain says the Commission seems keen to work with Vanuatu to address issues surrounding the scheme. And even if the proposal is agreed on by the EU states, there's a two-month window before it takes effect.
So that gives Vanuatu a two-month window in which it can work with the EU either to persuade them to change their minds or to convince them that they now do have in place appropriate measures that the EU can accept in order to not proceed with this suspension.
Dr. Tess Newton-Cain, project leader for the Griffith Asia Institute's Pacific Hub, and ending that report from Marion Farr. Now, barely a month after they were dispatched to Solomon Islands in the wake of riots on the streets of Honiara, a deployment of Australian military personnel has been withdrawn. Support for the local police is now in the hands of a small contingent of soldiers from New Zealand, Fiji and Papua New Guinea, who are due to remain in the country until March. But political scientist Dr. Tarsisius Kapitalaka from the Centre for Pacific Island Studies at the University of Hawaii says the security situation in the capital is a short-term matter, and the outcome of talks between the national government and the rebel province of Malaita is of far greater significance.
The bigger issue is addressing the underlying causes of what happened. And that's going to be long term. That belongs to the Solomon Islands government and the Solomon Islands people. I think that if we do not address those, whether we have international police presence or we ramp up the Solomon Islands police force, it's not going to solve the problems.
Well, speaking of some of those tensions, the government in recent weeks did accept help from China to equip the police to train them. How might this be viewed by people within the Solomon Islands and around the region as well?
Well, it's already been viewed by some as, you know, accepting more Chinese assistance and therefore more Chinese influence. But I think it's important to note that the Solomon Islands government, like governments elsewhere in the Pacific Islands region, accepts assistance from all its donor partners, whether they are Australia or New Zealand or Chinese or Japanese. And in this case, it's equipment from China. Solomon Islands has in the past accepted equipment from Australia, New Zealand and others as well. I don't think it's a big issue in the same way as others have made it to be.
Tarsisius, we spoke briefly before about that relationship between Malaita, the government and its people. There has been reports of talks between a delegation from the national government and the Malaita provincial government. How significant is this step towards reaching some form of resolution?
It is important. Any dialogue is important. And at the moment, it is between the Ministry of Provincial Government and the Malaita provincial government. And that's a good start. I'm hoping, however, that dialogue expands and also involves much higher offices, including the Prime Minister. And I think that's important. And then on top of that, I think it should also involve other provincial governments as well. Because whilst the current tension is between the Malaita provincial government and the national government, the issues are much broader and more national in nature. And therefore should be inclusive of other provinces, of church leaders, of women's organizations, and of young people who make up a large percentage of the country's population. But it's a good start. I'm glad that the Malaita provincial government and the central government, through the Ministry of Provincial Government, are having talks, because that will hopefully create understanding.
Well, looking more specifically into Honiara, Tarsisius, there was a Solomon Star newspaper report about the plans for the relocation of Chinatown. In your mind, do you think there is a need for it to be relocated, given that this is the second time that it's been looted and burnt?
Well, first, that report was very vague. It doesn't say who was involved in the discussion. The Premier for Guadalcanal Province reportedly said that he was not aware of any such discussions. So it's important to note that we don't know who's having the discussion about relocation. And it's important that the places that they were talking about relocating to is within Guadalcanal Province. And if the Guadalcanal Provincial Government is unaware of the discussion, it's something that we should note.
Dr. Tarsisius Kapitalaka from the Centre for Pacific Island Studies at the University of Hawaii, talking there to Marla Damadi. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review. 4 out of 5 of the emergency calls made in Port Moresby on New Year's Eve involved injuries caused by acts of violence, and police reports suggest many of those incidents were linked to excessive consumption of cheap alcohol. As a result, there are calls now for a review of the laws on the sale of cheap and high-strength liquor in Papua New Guinea's National Capital District, calls supported by the Chief Executive of St John Ambulance PNG, Matt Cannon.
We're seeing what appears to be spikes of violence in the community, and a commonality appears to be these high-strength, cheap liquors. This is resulting in us being called to violence that anywhere from physical violence, from fighting to knife wounds, and in extreme cases, gunshot wounds, and all other forms of trauma that comes with poor choices that can be sometimes made when intoxicated.
And Matt, when your team goes out to these calls, is the threat of violence something that they have to deal with as well?
Look, it's not uncommon. We've had occasional incidents in Port Moresby where what appear to be intoxicated people have thrown rocks at ambulances, and sometimes will verbally abuse the ambulance officers if they're doing their job.
So, Matt, you're joining calls from other authorities in Port Moresby to review the sale of this cheap liquor. Do you think that will address the issue, or are there other root causes that kind of surround this issue of alcohol consumption and its links to violence?
Well, look, certainly alcohol consumption is a complex issue, and there's not one perfect solution to the problem. But what seems to have worked in other areas has been increasing the price of per unit of alcohol. And we'd like to see that put on the table for discussion, for consideration here, as one of many options and one of many considerations. We're seeing these high-strength liquors, particularly drinks, you know, as cheap as $7 for 10 standard units of alcohol. You can understand how when that's mixed in with sugar and it tastes nice, it'd be very easy for someone to get unknowingly quite intoxicated, and with the added high sugar content, potentially quite aggressive. And that appears to be what we're seeing, and the anecdotal reports we're hearing from our ambulance officers and corroborating that with members of the community, they share the same concerns that we do for these high-strength, cheap liquors. Many people in the community that we talk to and that we hear from do have an understanding of the effects of alcohol. So education is an important part of the solution, and that's something that's you know, being on the table as a discussion amongst all the stakeholders in the coming weeks.
And Matt, I'd love to touch on some other issues as well. You know, being at the front lines with St. John's PNG, what is the COVID situation like at PNG at the moment? Is your team going out to calls? You know, what work is St. John doing in the COVID space?
Over the last 2 years, we've transported several hundred patients with COVID-19 by road and also by air. We're tracking the COVID outbreaks. We're working closely with the national government in support, and with other partners like the World Health Organization, in terms of using our data to track where we're seeing outbreaks. At the moment, in the last 7 days, the ambulance service across the country has not transported a single patient with a confirmed case of COVID-19, and the key word there is confirmed. We haven't seen a significant increase in calls for respiratory problems. It still sits at around 10 to 20% of our workload, which is a normal base level for us. Around 10 to 20% of our ambulance call-outs are related to respiratory problems, and that was similar before the pandemic. We are surprised, I guess, but not alarmed that we have no cases at the moment, but we're seeing Port Moresby General Hospital is still having a small trickle of cases of COVID-19 presenting to the emergency department, but we do remain vigilant.
That's Matt Cannon, Chief Executive Officer for St John Ambulance PNG. And finally, the one Olympic sport in which a number of Pacific Island nations are capable of mixing it with the world's best is weightlifting. So the idea that it could be excluded from the 2028 Games in Los Angeles by the International Olympic Committee has sent something of a shockwave across the region. The IOC is unhappy with the way that weightlifting is run and remains to be convinced that a sport with a long history of drug cheats is clean. However, no Pacific lifter has tested positive for a banned substance in over a decade. So the founder of the Oceania Institute, Paul Coffer, says his athletes are at the mercy of the International Weightlifting Federation. It is they, Coffer says, who have to put their own administrative house in order and who must crack down on the drug users.
Drugs has a lot to do with it, and that's got to be stopped. Oceania hasn't had a doping violation 15 years. We're incredible, but it's the other continents that keep bugging in with positive cases, and the IOC not going to accept that. And also, the executive board needs to restructure. Everything has got to be changed. And if the IWF, by 2023, comes up with a cleaner sport, nothing will change. We haven't been taken away, we've been warned.
As a weightlifter herself, Della Shaw Elder was coached by Paul Coffer, but now she's president of Fiji's National Federation, and she says the IWF have to heed the IOC's warning.
What I think is that the IWF has no choice. We have no choices, and there cannot be any compromises. The IOC would like to see changes, especially in the reforms and the total independence in terms of WADA and selecting the right people. If that is not done, we see weightlifting going on its way to self-destruction.
But ironically, the IOC's concerns about drugs in weightlifting would appear to lack foundation, at least at the moment, based on what happened at the Tokyo Games last year, albeit among a much reduced field of athletes because of COVID-19.
This is the first Olympics that we haven't had a positive case. It's not dozens and dozens and dozens like in the past. A lot of work has gone into it. And if we can continue this, well, then we're in business. If we don't, we will be out, no question.
That's a very good indication to the IOC that they can see that the IWF and also countries are working together to see that it's a clean sport. And with the finalization of the constitution, it was good to see that now they will be recognizing more women in the executive board. So that is good, and also with the independence of the drug testing.
Della Shaw Elder says Fiji is lobbying hard for the IWF to put its house in order and do nothing to threaten the sports Olympic standing any further. Because if the worst was to happen and weightlifting was dropped for 2028, she says the impact would be devastating.
With weightlifting being dropped as a Olympic sport, it will definitely kill the sport of weightlifting in the smaller nation, especially in the Pacific. The reduced funding, the direct impact that it will affect the elite athletes, the development that comes with it, the travel and even competition. We are also looking at the government interest. The government interests will be significantly reduced. More importantly, the hard work of the individual athletes have put through. Weightlifting Fiji has already completed our strategic plan, and our athletes are very aware of our next four-year plan. This will definitely kill the interest and the dreams, along with the goals and aspiration of everyone.
Della Shaw Elder is one of an increasing number of women taking up key administrative roles in weightlifting, and Paul Coffer says likely changes at the top will go a long way to appeasing the IOC.
The IOC said that they will review it in 2023. We need to change the culture of weightlifting regarding drugs and the organization itself. And this is what we're going to do. They're going to have an election in the next 2-3 months, and we're going to bring more women into the sport. You know, we never had women. We only had one. Now, you know, it is compulsory to bring women into the sport. We used to have one, and now we're going to have three representing the athletic commission. So things are changing in the sport of weightlifting.
While urging the IWF to implement reforms and meet the IOC deadline by the end of this year, Della Shaw Elder has been reflecting on how drug cheats impacted on her chances of success when she was still out there competing.
I would see the immense difference in terms of lifting scores that was totally different. And as an athlete at the time, I used to wonder, because I was trained under Paul Coffer. I was training at the Institute. And yes, as an athlete, I questioned myself and said, what are we doing that is different from them? And at that time, drugs was highly used.
Her hope now is that the influence of drugs on her sport has gone for good and that the IWF will ensure that remains the case. After the controversial departure of world-class Fijian lifter Eileen Thikamatana to Australia, Della Shaw Elder says they have worked hard to put the sport back on track in Fiji, and she doesn't want to see that enormous effort go to waste.
In the past, we had only 4 clubs. Now we have 5 active clubs with more than 40 active athletes competing in the national championship. In the past 2 years, we have accredited 15 coaches in total that have gone through level one and level two. And we hosted a successful junior world championship, and that was the first of its kind in the Pacific. So we basically have gone strength to strength, and we would like to see the sport of weightlifting continue to grow in Fiji, and we would not want to see the sport being removed as a Olympic program.
Della Shaw Elder, President of Weightlifting Fiji, rounding up this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Hewitt, and as always, thank you very much for listening.